Mr. President, whose idea was the initiative to China? Was it yours, Henry Kissinger's, or whose?
Well, to answer that question, I do not know when Dr. Kissinger may have conceived of the possibility of an initiative toward China. I do know that I conceived it before I ever met him, and that I pushed it very, very hard from the first days of the administration. I was the one, as he, of course, agrees, who raised the issue and kept pressing the issue, but he pursued it with enormous enthusiasm.
And in that first conversation with Mao, what was Chairman Mao most concerned to talk about? Was he most concerned to talk about Taiwan or wider issues?
In the first trip, Chairman Mao left most of the substantive matters to Zhou Enlai. What he was trying to do was to establish a personal relationship with the President of the United States, frankly, to take his measure, and I was naturally trying to take his. And as far as Taiwan is concerned, the only reference was with their incomparable humor. He said, "I see where your friend Chiang Kai-shek called me a bandit." And after the translation, I said, "What does the chairman call Chiang Kai-shek?" And he said, "I call him a bandit too." And then Zhou Enlai interspersed the comment. He says, "We just abuse each other." And then they both threw back their heads and laughed. And then Mao went on to say, "You know, we have been friends of Chiang Kai-shek much longer than you have been friends." He did not mean that they were friends now. He was referring to the fact that, of course, years before I ever met Chiang Kai-shek, which is in 1953, he had, of course, been his ally and friend. Zhou Enlai, of course, had worked with him and under him during the time that Chiang Kai-shek was the leader of the Nationalist Chinese in World War II. Now, what he did, however, have the greatest interest in was in the attitude that the United States would have toward the attempts of any country to impose its rule or its influence on Asia, and that particularly meant on China and on its neighbor. The code word is hegemony. It's what they were referring to as far on the Chinese side. Was they didn't want the Soviet Union to impose its force on them.
Do you think that there could ever be a rapprochement? I mean, do you think that in fact China and Russia are set for the next foreseeable future on opposing courses, or could there become a new intimate closeness between the two communist superpowers?
I do not see a rapprochement. There's an interesting story. Well, I can bring it more up to date than 72, which perhaps I should. In 76, this subject came up with Hua. He brought it up. He says, "Let me tell you what happened when Premier Kosygin met with Chairman Mao back in 1965. He says, "They talked for days, and hours on hours each day, about their differences. And at the conclusion, Chairman Mao told Kosygin, he said, "Our differences are going to continue for 10,000 years. And Kosygin said, "Well, Mr. Chairman, after these long discussions we've had and the reassurances I've given you, don't you think you could reduce that number somewhat?" And Mao, with that devilish sense of humor he has, said, "Well, in view of the very persuasive arguments that the Premier has made, I'll knock off 1,000 years. Our disputes will continue for 9,000 years. And then Hua went on to say, "That's the way we look at it now."
Did you feel you had a tacit assurance that they would not ever use force on the issue of Taiwan, or not?
No, I would not say that we had, we certainly did not have an express assurance. And not having an express assurance I would say I did not feel we had a tacit assurance, but I feel that as far as Taiwan is concerned, that China's internal problems are so great, and the external threat, the only major external threat that they face from the Soviet Union, is so immediate that the Chinese do not want to become involved in military action, even on an issue as sensitive as Taiwan.
After the enormous impact of that trip in 72, there was a general optimistic assumption that there'd be rapid steps leading to full diplomatic relations between the United States and China and so on. But the obstacle on the formal exchange of embassies is our recognition of Taiwan.
Oh, absolutely. There will be no formal exchange of embassies unless the United States breaks relations with Taiwan. It will not happen. As far as my present view is concerned, I stand on the Shanghai communique, and I would suggest, however, that there may be areas, and I think it would be proper to discuss this publicly even at this point, where in the field of trade we could make some moves now, like granting MFN, most favored nation treatments to China, discussing and solving the problem of blocked assets. Here are areas. I'm not sure that this is the time to do it or not, but these are subjects that could be discussed, which do not require normalization in order to discuss them.
Détente. Détente was at the heart of your big power negotiation. But there had been peaceful coexistence, so-called, before that, which had involved some treaties banning certain forms of nuclear testing, attempting to deal with the problem of nuclear proliferation and so on. How would you define at the very heart the difference between peaceful coexistence and détente as you conceived it?
People talk about détente, and they talk about peace, they talk about friendship, and they talk about coexistence. Now, what it really all gets down to is how two great powers, the two major powers in the world, are going to be able to talk about their differences rather than fight about them. You've got to set up a relationship on a personal basis or in some fashion whereby the differences can be discussed and the areas of self-interest can be discovered, worked out, and then increased. And that is what détente is about.
So that when, for instance, in 73, the Russians were supplying Egypt and leading up to the Yom Kippur October War, would you have said that that was contrary to the intent of SALT, which refers to not increasing international tensions and so on, or what you would have expected as a Russian tactic towards what was then a client?
Well, let us look at what led up to that particular event. At Summit 2, which occurred in Washington at Camp David and in San Clemente, there had been a very spirited, and I must say at times heated, discussion of the Mideast. It started in my home, where we'd had dinner for Brezhnev for 3 hours until past midnight. Brezhnev hammered me on the Mideast. He said, "You must force the Israelis to withdraw from all of the occupied territories, and they must do it soon." And I told him, "We can't do that." I said, "We cannot impose a settlement." And I said, "You can't impose a settlement." I said, "It must be worked out between the parties." Now, I felt that the interests of Israel would be served by talking with their neighbors. I thought the interests would be served by negotiating with their neighbors in terms of adjusting the borders in some way. And I still believe that. And they know that. But on the other hand, I knew that the Israelis would not and could not simply withdraw to the 67 borders, and that for me to tell Brezhnev and to promise him that I would force the Israelis to do it, and that he'd go tell the Egyptians and the Syrians that, would be a promise that I couldn't deliver on. I refused to make it. I said to Brezhnev on this occasion, let us clearly understand that both of us must use our strength to restrain our friends. You've got to restrain the Egyptians and the Syrians, and we'll restrain the Israelis, and we both must try to push our friends to sit down at the conference table and negotiate out some of these differences. Now, that happened in June. Then, as the months wore on, Brezhnev's prediction, which he made at that time, proved true. Whether it was a self-fulfilling prediction or not, I do not know. But he said, it is my concern that unless the Israelis do withdraw, if the Egyptians and the Syrians are going to attack, and they're going to attack soon. I said, if they do attack, I said, we will not let Israel go down the tube, or words to that effect. At least he got the message. Now, there's where we were then, when this war broke out. And now let me tell you how I got the news of the war, which shows you the brilliance of our intelligence, and in this case, of the Israeli intelligence. Israeli intelligence, incidentally, is probably as good as any in the world, next to perhaps the Russian intelligence. But in any event, I was going to go to Key Biscayne at the time, the week the Yom Kippur War broke out. I mean, it was holiday and all the rest. And I got the intelligence report from the CIA that day. And the intelligence report said that an armed attack is possible, but unlikely. The next morning, I got a telephone call from Washington that Egypt had attacked.
But do you think the Russians knew in advance there was going to be an attack?
All that I can say is that we did not know it. As to whether or not the Russians did know it, I would say if they did know it and did not inform us, that would have been, I think, a very great breach of all of the understandings we had, regardless of what we had agreed on paper, even in Summit 2.
There were a lot of reports in Israel that there was a phone conversation with Golda Meir soon after the war began over supplies.
Oh, yes. I had several conversations with her. The main point of the matter was this. Her concern was that because of the strike, they were losing a great deal of equipment. She needed equipment. Then came the Russian airlift. It was then that I made a very critical decision in the early time of the war that if the Russians were sending an airlift in, as they were, to help the Egyptians and to help the Syrians, that we would airlift to help Israel. I remember the conversation very well when I had asked the Defense Department and they prepared an option paper or what have you for Kissinger to provide the method for doing it. At first, we wanted to cover the situation, or they did, and send this, paint some planes differently and make it appear as if they were LL planes, I mean, Israeli planes or something like that. And I said, look, Henry, we're going to get just as much blame for sending three if we send 30 or 100 or whatever we've got. So send everything that flies. The main thing is make it work.
Now, as the tide of the battle turned in the Israelis' favor, Henry Kissinger on October the 19th went at short notice to Moscow.
Yes.
What was the background to his going?
In the early part of this war, the Israelis begged us not to support a ceasefire resolution. And we didn't. We didn't support it. We filibustered it. We did everything to stop it. Why? Why didn't the Israelis want a ceasefire in the early part of it? Because at that point, they were losing. You never want a ceasefire when the other guy's on your territory. Okay. Now comes the Kissinger's trip to Moscow. Now comes the Israelis, as a result of our help and their good fighting qualities and the rest, our military left and their fighting qualities. Now they're on top. It was then that the Egyptians made the move to ask for a joint American-Soviet force to come in and keep the peace. We rejected that. I said, look, I remember one day in the cabinet room, very clearly, I said, Henry, I said, this idea of the Russians having two Russian infantry divisions going to the Mideast and putting themselves down in Egypt and Syria, and we send two American Marine divisions into Israel in order to keep the peace there. I said, this is sheer madness. I said, it may keep the peace, but it runs into the possibility of a big power conflict. I said, also, you're not going to get many American public support for sending the Marines or Army or, for that matter, Air Force, I don't care what it is, into this place where nobody knows what's going to happen. Regardless of what the Russians would do, what would other people do? It would be a dangerous situation, far more dangerous than the Marine landing in Lebanon when the United States was so overwhelmingly powerful that the Russians wouldn't have dared to move in. So I said, we can't do it. It was then, however, that Brezhnev sent a note to us. This note, to me, had an ominous sound to it.
Was it a threat?
What?
Was it a threat?
I prefer my words. He didn't use the word threat. And I'm not going to go to that point. The note had an ominous sound to it because he, in effect, said that the United States and the Soviet Union should move in, as the Egyptians had requested. He knew we had rejected that. And he said, if you do not move unilaterally, if you do not move in, and if you cannot restrain the Israelis, as seems to be the case at this point, or is the case at this point, and I'm paraphrasing, and it's my recollection, he said, it will be necessary for us to move unilaterally into the situation. Now that, to me, was a code word for the Soviet Union to move any kind of forces unilaterally into the Mideast would first tip the balance so that Israel had been down the tube. But even more important, it would have established the precedent where the Soviet had a presence in the Mideast, and unless, and a predominant position, and one that would require us from our national self-interest to try to balance it off. And so it ran the risk of a great power confrontation. So it wasn't just because we wanted to save Israel, which we did want to do. We wanted to save Egypt too. We wanted to save Syria too. We wanted to keep peace in the area. But it was because we did not want to have major powers rubbing together in a critical area of the world like the Mideast, far where their interests are far more involved than they were in Vietnam. It was because of that that I decided that we had to take a strong position, and that's why, with Kissinger's, Schlesinger's, everybody else's approval, we decided on the course of an alert.
Now, is that what you said in your reply to him? Did you tell him you were going on a nuclear alert?
No. No, I just said in my reply that we would not agree to go in. I indicated, second, we would be glad, of course, to participate in a UN group with a small number of advisors and so forth to supervise a ceasefire. And third, that we took a very dim view, I use stronger words than that, a very dim view of any unilateral action on their part of moving in.
And in fact,
but you see, let me point out, here it shows you the interrelationship of one event with another. It shows you, you say, what is detente? Well, detente doesn't bring instant peace. You don't settle everything peacefully. You don't avoid every conflict. You set up a procedure whereby, knowing each other, leaders may, even when they come into disagreement involving potential conflict, are able to settle it before the flashpoint. Brezhnev knew from that tough conference I had had with him in San Clemente, that 3 hours before midnight, in which I had taken a firm line that we would not tolerate action that would destroy Israel, that we would stand by our friends, and he had to restrain his, and we would restrain ours, He had to remember that. And the alert, therefore, in that context, and also in the context of what I had earlier done in Vietnam, I think meant a lot more to him than it would otherwise have meant if we had not had the so-called detente.
How much did we know at that point, at the time you issued the alert, about the movements the Russians were making in terms of Soviet divisions and ships and Antonovs and so on?
All we have here is a collection of information. Some of it may be misinformation. One bit of information was that a ship had certain nuclear components in it. We do know that several Soviet divisions were alerted. We do know that certain ships were in place, that the number of Soviet ships in that area was 85, the greatest number they'd ever had in that Black Sea, I should say, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Black Sea, and, of course, the Straits. So under the circumstances, there was, we considered to be, very substantial evidence that the Soviet had the capability in place and might use that capability to move in unilaterally. This is why the note from Brezhnev had an ominous sound to it, having in mind these items of intelligence, none of which I could be sure of, but all of which I had to take into account in view of the previous record. And I felt that we had to take a strong stand, and the alert, which, as you know, is at the third level of our alerts, I felt would be a message which would get through.
And did the Russians also send Scud missiles to Egypt? I mean, missiles capable of firing nuclear warheads?
There were reports to that effect. I am not able to confirm them.
You don't know, or you can't?
I don't know, no. I mean, I'm not trying to hide anything. I can't recall. I can only recall that I read reports and heard reports at that time.
But didn't we have to put pressure on the Israelis to agree to a ceasefire? I mean, I know they would have not wanted one earlier, but they must have been very tempted to wipe out the Egyptian Third Army. How did we manage to persuade them to stop?
Well, the Israelis, when you talk about pressure, I would have to say, yes, they would have liked to have wiped out the Egyptian Third Army. But if the Israelis had insisted on capturing and destroying the Egyptian Third Army, that would have brought about, I predict, that a coup or worse, as far as Sadat was concerned. Somebody would have come into power in Egypt, probably worse than Nasser, oriented toward the radical point of view. Egypt would have become a total Soviet satellite state, and Israel would have won a Pyrrhic victory. They would have planted the seeds for a war of revenge such as you've never seen. And therefore, we were right in restraining Israel, right from their own self-interest.
What was the bottom line then, really, that you had the leverage, and the bottom line, probably never stated, was if you don't go along with this ceasefire, the United States will not be able to...
Well, no, we didn't put the Israelis in the spot where we were trying to threaten them, because they won't take it. I mean, they're not. They'll never take it, and we wouldn't put them in that spot. What we did was to reason with them, but reason with them in a way. We in effect, if I may paraphrase from The Godfather, we gave them an offer that they could not refuse, and the offer basically was, look, the United States will continue to stand by you. We have demonstrated that we will come to your aid with arms if you come under attack. But third, on your side, if we will take such great risks, including not only the airlift, but an alert in order to save you, you must listen to us, at least, in terms of being reasonable in talking to your potential enemies.